Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I just realized that I'm looking at my bookshelf, and that the first two books in my bookshelf are, in order, Give War a Chance by P.J. O'Rourke and Peace Kills by P.J. O'Rourke, which is interesting because P.J. O'Rourke has a new book out. It's excerpted in the Bulwark today, and he joins me on the Bulwark Podcast. Good to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Yes, and it sounds like I'm sending mixed messages there with my books, which is true. It's true.
Well, we've moved on to a kinder and gentler era, right? Your new book is A Cry from the Far Middle, Dispatches from a Divided Land.
Yes. I'm trying to bring peace in our time, I believe, is the by winning the hearts and minds of, you know, how the rest of that goes.
Well, this is the problem of being in the middle, right? It's like I'm trying to think of the analogy that I once heard about. You know, the armadillo in the middle of the road is basically just the yellow streak or the red streak. I mean, it is hard to be a centrist or a in the middle in an era in which everybody is at the farthest possible corners, screaming at the top of their lungs.
With the help of the internet, of course, where, you know, no matter how wrong you are, you can reliably find a large group of people who are even wronger and and join up with them. I'm not really asking for centrism. I'm just sort of asking for people to get back to being mad at each other in a normal manner, please. There are plenty of really contentious political issues that we need to deal with in America and around the world. Issues, you know, having to do with the social safety network and entitlement programs, budget deficits, foreign policy, of course, which is always a huge headache because it's kind of controlled by foreigners. What can you do here? There are all sorts of things that we should be arguing about, maybe even arguing angrily and bitterly about. But let's get back to doing that in the normal Ike versus Adlai Stevenson sort of framework of I'm not asking for civility exactly, but I am asking a whole bunch of people to shut up and go away,
and maybe not be so dumb.
And not be so dumb, yeah.
So I just opened up to your chapter on social media, whose headline is, Whose Bright Idea Was It to Make Sure That Every Idiot in the World Was in Touch with Every Other Idiot?
Yeah. I mean,
that is kind of the problem, right? That, you know, social media polarizes our politics by allowing us all, no matter how wrong we are about a political issue, to find a large, enthusiastic group of people who are even wronger.
Yeah.
It feels like a death spiral.
And join arms with them. You know, I think we can date this problem back to long before the internet. There was an idea that began to emerge in the 50s and was really around in force in the 1960s that we need to communicate. That the only reason that the world was having a Cold War and all this, and that America was having its racial tensions and so on, so we weren't communicating with each other. And we thought that Marshall McLuhan was this great visionary because he said that the television would create a global village, you know, where I guess that mm-hmm. same village that Hillary Clinton was going to use to raise her children. Or Bill, yeah. Whoever it was that needed some adult supervision. Well, of course, we actually hadn't read McLuhan. And I mean, we just sort of glommed onto him as for a few of his big quotes, Global Village thing, notably. And McLuhan's opinion was, I said we'd have a global village. I didn't say the villagers would like each other. And I managed to track down an obscure radio interview conducted in Ottawa, Canada, I think during the late 60s or early 70s, where McLuhan comes out and just says, you know, that the closer people get to each other, the deeper their animus, the worse their hatred, the more closely interconnected. He said, He said, yes, I say the world is going to be more closely interconnected. Is that going to lead to people liking each other better? I've never seen any example of that around the world. And those of us who live in small towns know just how heated that sort of thing can get.
Well, and also everybody feels the need to have an opinion about everything. I mean, there was once a time when we weren't not only thrust into each other's faces, but we didn't have to have pretend to have all this deep knowledge about everything. I mean, I really wrestle with this. I know you're an H.L. Mencken fan, right?
I mean, you're an
H.L. Mencken. You know, H.L. Mencken did something that almost no pundit these days dares to do. And that's what I think makes it so refreshing. He was prepared to say that one of the problems with democracy is that people are stupid, right? That we had an idiocracy. And nobody else will ever say that because we all have to pretend that, well, the American people is too smart to fall for this, or the American people is savvy enough. And
50% of people are below average in intelligence. Mathematical fact. There is no way around it.
I mean, maybe at some point people once had a better sense of the limits of their own knowledge. There were fewer outlets for people to dispense, to display their ignorance and then to have that ignorance validated by others. So basically, I screwed up something this morning. I wanted to confess to it and bounce it off you. Okay,
sure.
Because I have a daily newsletter, and I'm writing about one of the factors in the election that is sometimes discounted is just the spread of crazy, the number of just absolutely batshit crazy voters that are out there. And twice in the last 2 days, I've talked to national reporters who came into Wisconsin and were struck by the number of people who began spouting conspiracy theories that they got online. And I actually quoted, Bob Costa from the Washington Post, who goes to crucial Waukesha County, which you've heard of.
Yes.
And he meets this 59-year-old woman who basically, starts going off that, she used to get her information from Fox News Channel, and now she's watching the X-22 report, which is this far right wing conspiracy theory YouTube channel. And she's absolutely convinced that George Soros is funding all of the riots in Kenosha.
George must be rich, because there have been a lot of riots.
I know he's bankrolling all of them. So she has all of these conspiracy theories. So I quoted this as like, this is really disturbing. This is happening. But what I neglected to mention was the first paragraph. Her name is Yvonne. I can't pronounce her last name. Yvonne, 59. This is the way Bob Costa describes it. Yvonne blank, 59, sat outside a Waukesha bar Wednesday morning with a raspberry White Claw in hand and described the Democratic voting tendencies of her youth. Okay, that's far. So, okay, Wisconsin has its own weirdness, but, maybe it's a tell that you're interviewing that, man on the street interview is with a person who's sitting outside a bar in the morning already drinking. I mean, Wisconsin, we drink, but maybe that's a little bit of an indication that this is not the typical voter out there. I mean, if I wanted to, find out what is America thinking, do I go into some woman who's smoking a cigarette, sitting outside a bar, drinking a White Claw at 9:30 in the morning? I don't know.
Of course you do. Of course you do. It's all about, if you can't find actual blood in the streets, we all know if it bleeds, it leads. But also if it drinks, it talks.
And will be colorful.
It'll be colorful. You always go for the colorful character. As a reporter walking down the street with, say, 500, 600 normal people within view, you naturally go directly to the person dressed as a circus clown, for no discernible reason,
That's right.
Though the circus isn't in town. And so we do have, is the craziness quotient in America any worse than it ever was?
Yeah.
I doubt it. I think we've always been a pretty crazy country. founded by crazy people. If you think about the whole Mayflower venture, right from the Jump Street, we were pretty crazy. They're easier to hear from now, and reporters lacking any real news, because real news could get you tear gassed or beaten or looted or chased around the street by both sides. We naturally go for the colorful.
Sure. Well, now, and by the way, you mentioned something, and we excerpt your book in The Bulwark today, and one of the quotes that jumped out
and
at
thank
me
you,
was,
I wanted yeah, to say.
Well, thank you. But one of the quotes from you that jumped out at me was, our country was founded by the delusional and the crazy, populated by the desperate and the unwilling, motivated by most of the seven deadly sins, and is somehow the richest and most powerful nation on earth ever.
Amazing, isn't it? That's the one thing Mencken didn't understand about democracy is the noise-canceling effect that democracy has, is that the two sides of the crazy tend to cancel each other out under ideal circumstances, leaving normal people in the middle to have normal arguments about normal things, fact-ish based, at least. At the moment, the noise from both ends is drowning out what I'm sure is the great majority of Americans who are a little puzzled about this, that, and the other thing, willing to admit their ignorance about this, that, or the other thing, willing to sit down and talk with their neighbor about this, that, or the other.
Well, that is the gap. And, you know, I think one of the great challenges, and we talked about this right before we started doing this, is how do you navigate this time without losing your mind? How do you not go crazy? Because I think there's real pressure on people. I mean, you add in the politics, and then, of course, you have the pandemic and the quarantine and just all of the other strangeness that we have. And I think a lot of Americans are just on the edge. And then if you go to escape from that into social media, it's like you've just jumped into the hole. So, I mean, you know, that is the challenge. Isn't that one of the major challenges of our time is how not to lose your freaking mind? You know,
absolutely. And then for those of us who are in the media business, it's very hard to attract any attention with a moderate view. I mean, let's be honest about ourselves. We want attention, you know. I mean, we want attention. We make our livelihood by getting attention, and it's very hard in these circumstances to get any attention without anything radical to say. I mean, I've had a couple of like TV talk show producers call me up and say, you know, would you like to come on about this or that or the other thing? And when I explain that, gee, you know, my opinions about, you know, Medicare for all and so on are actually kind of moderate. I'm a little puzzled about this aspect. And the other aspect, I think Obamacare is a ridiculously complicated law. I think it focuses on insurance when it should focus on healthcare. But, you know, do I want to deny healthcare to people because of their, I mean, nobody should be beggared by their medical bills. Nobody should lose the house, the boat, maybe, mm-hmm. but not the house, you know? Anyway, the more I go on about like, how sort of in the middle I am about a lot of things, the less interested they are in having me on the show. I don't think we're going to get any fireworks. This is a damp squib.
Well, and it's not just the fireworks they're looking for. I think a lot of it is fan service, because I have been struck by just the amount of time on cable television that is taken up by what I describe as just sort of these monologue word salads of saying the same thing that you have been saying for 4 years. And it's like, for I think a lot of viewers, it's like just hearing their views ratified is like slipping into a warm bath. This is good. No, nobody's saying anything new. Nobody's saying anything original. They're not even saying it in an interesting way. It's just the, okay, I am right. I hate the right people. And I hate them for the right reasons.
And I understand that perfectly. When I was covering the Iraq War in 2003, I had two little kids and my wife back home, and I wasn't in any actual danger. I was sort of stuck in Kuwait for most of the thing. But anyway, I said to my wife, I want you to watch Fox News and only Fox News, because whatever is actually happening over here, we're winning on Fox News. Okay, so just stay with Fox News. Okay, and don't
keep your
worry
spirits
about
up.
Keep your spirits up. Don't worry about your husband.
So, you know, I mentioned that there are not many pundits like H.L. Mencken willing to say that people can be stupid. You, however, do not have qualms about all of that. And in fact,
no,
you have a,
but let's go back to Mencken for a moment.
And okay, please.
Mencken's great error in where one comes apart from Mencken is that he had no alternative to democracy. And, you know, if you listen to him in, or read him in the 1930s, he wasn't a fascist sympathizer,
no.
but he definitely leaned in the direction of
a you could read that into some of the things he's saying.
Yes, you could, you know, and as we all know, what was actually going on at that time was super duper unpleasant in a way that no democracy has ever produced that kind of unpleasantness. And so Mencken was unwilling to fully relax and accept the stupidity as the price we pay for having a government that's all in common for the whole bunch of us. It just has to be factored in, you know, even when it's at its loudest as it is at the moment.
Well, actually, since you mentioned that, and because I'm kind of a nerd on all of this, in the last couple of nights, I have actually been reading some of Mencken's political commentary from the 1930s. And one of the things that interested me is that, like, for example, in 1935 and 36, he's a brilliant guy. I love his stuff, but he was a terrible pundit. But also the difference of political punditry back then when you had no access to any polls of any kind. So you kind of had to make up what you thought was happening. So he would write these things about how terrified the Republicans were of Al Smith running as a Democrat. Or in 1935, it seemed like he thought there was a very real possibility Franklin Roosevelt would be defeated for a second term. He was not a Roosevelt fan. To read his commentary about the Republican maneuvering in 1936 to beat Franklin Roosevelt, who, of course, won by this overwhelming landslide, is interesting to realize that, you know, we have all of these tools and stuff to at least have a reality check on us once in a while. It doesn't mean we don't get things horrifically wrong, but Mencken's
Hillary.
Powers of prediction were limited.
Yes, and they still are.
That's right. We still screw up. So in your book, by the way, I really enjoyed your AOC joke, which I know you gave credit to somebody else for it. But I mean, there are just for people out there who trigger warning among our center left listeners there. There's a great AOC joke about socialism. And you wrote a lot about, you know, you sort of the new fascination, the new generational fascination with socialism, wealth taxes, eating the rich and all of this. And can I just read just a little bit from one passage where you're talking about all the, you know, socialist young people, you know, who are, you know, sitting around college seminar rooms who are talking about if we could just abolish the rich. And you point out that, maybe we should, you know, send them back to the real world, you know, send them back to factories or at least the barn. If I hear any socialist noise from my kids, I'm going to make them get up at 4 a.m. to milk the cows. And this will be an extra onerous farm chore because we don't have any cows, and they'll have to search for miles all over the countryside to find some. They've got it coming. Young people are not only penniless and powerless, they're also ignorant as hell. They think of wealth as something that's limited, like the number of Hostess ding-dongs at the 7-Eleven shelf. They think rich people got to the 7-Eleven first and gobbled all the ding-dongs, leaving poor people to lick the plastic wrappers. Young people don't know that more ding-dongs can be produced. By the way, this is the best description of socialism capitalism that I've read in ages. Just right there.
Well, thank you. and it does. I mean, I do try to point to, like, the fundamental socialist fallacy is that there's a limited amount of goods and services that somehow has to be divided up more fairly. And of course, the answer to is the old John F. Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats, unless, of course, your anchor chain is much too short, in which case you drown.
He didn't really.
And he was a seaworthy fellow. He should have known better than to use that metaphor. this idea of limited means, the zero sum fallacy, is at the core of what's wrong with socialism. The other thing that's at the core of why socialism is so nominally popular at the moment, is that 1989 was a long time ago, when all this, when socialism around the world began to collapse, and it began to collapse even earlier than that. In China, it was in the late 70s when China began to open to free enterprise. These kids weren't born. This is all ancient history to them. I was figuring out, I was doing the math, that for my oldest daughter, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall is as long ago for her as the Great Depression was for me. Right. And I remember when I was her age, you know, saying to my parents, why are you wrapping up that tiny piece of cheese, that tiny piece of rock hard cheese that was left over from last week's tuna casserole? Why are you wrapping that up and keeping it in the fridge? Well, rationing might happen again, or, you know, we could be broke tomorrow, you know, or, you know, they didn't say that, but that was the look on their face. And I'm going, no, that was, and then, you know, for my, for that same daughter, China's opening to the world of capitalism, that would take us back to like the Kellogg brand peace pact of the 1920s, you know, presumably a treaty about breakfast cereal, not weaponizing them.
No, this stuff that blows my mind. I do the same thing. I was reading, you know, Newt Gingrich was saying the other day that Donald Trump should do what Richard Nixon did to George McGovern, you know, and radicalize him. Well, that was 1972. Do a little quick math. That's 48 years ago. That would be like in 1972, giving people advice of what someone did in the 1924 election.
Right. Newt's showing his age there, you know. Yeah. Actually, 1972, that was the first real story I ever recovered as a reporter, were the Democratic and Republican conventions in Miami Beach.
And that was wild.
That was a while ago. And opinion polls weren't as fully developed. I mean, it was pretty clear to some people, at least, that McGovern probably wasn't going to win. But it wasn't clear to the Democrats at the time. And I was still this like sort of shaggy hippie looking character. And in those days, there wasn't much security around the conventions. And I had press credentials, and I was looking for the press entrance to the convention center. And there was like one good old boy guard leaning back on his chair, smoking a Marlboro, who was guarding the entrance. And I said, is this the press entrance? And he says, nope, this is the delegate entrance. Are you a delegate? And I said, no, I'm actually a member of the press. And he said, yeah, I didn't think you looked dirty enough to be a delegate. And then I thought,
whoa,
goodbye, George.
Yeah. That was the amnesty. What was it? Acid amnesty and abortion campaign.
Yes. Yeah. $1,000 for each American. Boy, well, that was considered like wildly radical at the time. $1,000 for each American. You know, now Republicans are handing that kind of stuff out on a monthly basis.
Yeah, and now it's sort of Andrew Yang nerdy, but yeah. Well, yeah. Speaking of which, I'm eagerly awaiting when Republicans rediscover their fiscal conservatism under the next administration after the trillions of dollars that they've spent. But that's kind of a different story. But
but isn't that fiscal responsibility is something that would seem to be kind of hiding in plain sight from the Republicans, you know? We might even call it the elephant in the room. What is going on? When did Republicans become advocates of rolling the printing presses down at the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, you know, night and day until they catch fire?
Well, it's not a surprise that Donald Trump wants to do that. I mean, he's the king of debt, right? So we should have known that. Yeah. It's everyone else. I mean,
everyone else.
I can't tell you the number of Lincoln Day dinners that I had to go to and eat bad chicken and everything and listen to people talk about the debt and the deficit. And because I live in Wisconsin. So, of course, I was right next door to Paul Ryan. So I, you know,
right. You got an earful.
Burned into my head all of this. And it's like, what the hell? Not to mention, I don't know. We're falling into the I'm old enough to remember, but I do this all the time anyway.
Yeah.
You know, could you think about where we were in the 1980s? about the, you know, the world. I mean, you wrote a lot about, you know, peace kills and all that good stuff. And but could you ever imagine a Republican Party that would be on its knees before Vladimir Putin?
No, I just, you know, it's like something's gone seriously wrong here. Something's arguably gone seriously wrong with both parties, but it's gone wronger with the Republicans. I just don't know what happened. There's been some sort of mental collapse, and maybe it will be followed by, I mean, we don't have political parties in a European sense in the United States. There's no card. You can't be expelled. If you donate so much as a nickel to either political party, you can't help but join.
Yeah.
We have two broad tendencies, you know, which are that, you know, government should fix the problem is one broad tendency, and the other broad tendency is government is the problem. And you can hold both of these going down to the Social Security office to sign up for your benefits, and you can hold both of these ideas in your mind at the same time, and most Americans do. Government should fix the problem, and government is the problem. And somebody's just lost sight of something. And coming back to the fiscal thing, you know, is that this printing money thing, this has been tried. We have experimental evidence here. It's called Weimar Germany.
Again and again.
Again and again. I have framed on my office wall a Zimbabwean banknote for 100 trillion Zimbabwe dollars.
I have the same one. I love that thing.
Yeah, and it's decorated with a picture of a pile of rocks,
mm-hmm.
Which apparently symbolizes something for somebody.
Artful, no.
Yeah.
You had a pre-preface. Every author that comes up with a book during this period has to update it. And I talked to Brian Stelter yesterday, and he obviously he threw on a new introduction a couple of months ago. You have a pre-preface as we go to press. So you must have updated this like 5 minutes ago as you write. While this book was being written in 2019, America was deep in an era of idiot populism and hooligan partisanship. And then it talked about our socio-political Peloponnesian war in the midst of this long, confusing, tedious, useless, foolish conflict that threatened to destroy democracy. Then, when this book was being edited and typeset, somebody ate an undercooked bat in a Wuhan wet market. So, and here we are. So give me your sense of the pandemic and the crisis. I mean, you sat down to write this introduction while the, after the police shootings and the chaos and the president deciding to pour more jet fuel on it.
I wrote it before all that. Things were just bad.
The kind of gentler
like the good old days.
No, but I mean, that's the thing is like 2019, we thought, man, things can't get any worse. Things can't get any crazy. And then
never say that.
Never say that.
That's the old Irish superstition of is to say it is to summon it. Never say things can't get worse. Things have a remarkable ability to get worse. And the rioting, the ugly turn that the demonstrations mm-hmm. have taken, which I partly chalk down to the pressure that everybody's been under from the pandemic is making everybody a little squirrely. I was talking to my shrink, as a matter of fact, and my shrink had just been on vacation with a bunch of other shrinks, and they were all comparing notes, and he said, everybody is on something.
Really?
It
feels
kind of
way.
The way it looks. Actually, but he was, talking about like calm down and cool out medications. I think everybody's on something on crack or something. There may be a little self-medicating going on out in the world. Ooh.
Oh, more than a little. So, I mean, that's why people are drinking White Claw in Waukesha County at 9:30 in the morning outside of a bar.
And talking to reporters, which is something else. No, you can tell a sane person because they won't talk to a reporter.
So at the end of the preface, you're talking about, journalists are supposed to provide answers, but all I've got is questions, starting with, isn't somebody supposed to be in charge? Too many of America's elected leaders have been acting as if the pandemic is a children's party game where they are all blindfolded and swinging sticks, except they're clobbering each other instead of the virus pinata. it does feel like, you know, we our system is so dysfunctional that nobody actually has ideas for solving problems. And now suddenly we're confronted with a real, very, very tangible problem. And their utter uninterest in actually solving it is pretty graphically on display.
You bet it is. You know, I mean, any kind of leadership would have been better than none, even if Trump had led us in radically the wrong direction, whatever direction that may be. You know, it would have shown something. You know, I sort of despair of the situation and all this noise. The anger and the noise pretty much chases off stage anybody who might be saying, look, let's, you know, try and figure this out. Let's sit down and calmly analyze the situation. Let's time out. You know,
you'd hope.
You know, nobody's listening to the referee. The referee's blowing his whistle and nobody can hear it.
Okay, so you wrote the last line of your pre-preface. Is I'm betting that human nature will triumph over adversity and challenge. And I don't mean that in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. What I was basically saying there is, will we emerge from this pandemic and this political crisis, the anger, the violence and all that's going on? Will we emerge with this new, sensible, pragmatic idea of regarding government as essentially a machine and trying to make this machine like work to both provide us with the benefits at a reasonable cost of expenditure of energy and money? Or having been cooped up in the house for a year, will we emerge more angry and crazy and addled than ever? Because that's often the way human nature works. And hence, that's why I'm betting on human nature. And I don't mean it in a good way.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with you on all of that. Now, how have you lived through the pandemic? You live out in the country. You're a writer. You're, you know, self-employed. You've been successful. I'm guessing that you've been okay.
Yeah, it really hasn't affected my life very much at all, except that I used to travel to give some lectures and, you know, go to meetings and so on. And I found that I didn't really miss that. When it got complicated was right now, when the kids go back to school. I've got a 22-year-old daughter who virtually graduated from Tulane and is now virtually looking for a job, whether that's virtually, you know, I haven't the slightest idea. She doesn't know what to do with herself.
This is a stressful time of life for people of that age group. When you're if you're just about to launch now,
yeah.
I've actually one of my sons. I was talking to him, and he's finishing up graduate school, and I could just feel that, you know, to launch your career, that uncertainty right now with everything has got to be immensely stressful.
And it is. I'm watching it around the house every day. And then I've got my middle daughter is has gone back to Texas A&M, where she goes to school. And basically, she's just locked in her off-campus apartment doing all her classes online. And they've got a little friend pod, but, you know, somebody gets a Q-tip up the nose every 3 minutes, I think, or so. And like, they're all like, you know, it's like 100 degrees down there and they won't even get in their apartment building swimming pool, which already puts her in college has changed since my day. And then I've got my youngest kid.
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. If you're wondering why it costs $40,000 a year, could have something to do with that student residence swimming pool and climbing wall and indoor gym and so on. And then I've got a 16-year-old who's a junior. He's a day student at this local prep school, and he is under so many restrictions and regulations. I am actually supposed to report myself to the boys' dean if I do something like drive to Boston or have encounters with strangers. I'm supposed to call the boys' dean and say so. So now things motored along pretty quietly for me for a while, and now I'm going crazy.
Well, that I kind of wonder also whether it's going to get worse, which it will. Now that the weather's getting colder and everything, because the I was going to say before, I think the world is divided into people who live in apartments versus people who have houses who can get outside and be in their yard and do things. I can't even imagine what it must be like to live in an apartment under these circumstances. At least we've had summer so that people could be outside, but
on the fire escape, if nothing else, you know.
Yeah. And now we're going, it's getting darker and it's getting colder. I think all of these pressures are going to, you know, be that much worse. But half the nation, you've noticed this though, has just basically said, "Hey, we're bored with this. We have short attention span and we're just done." It was like, right around Memorial Day, remember this? It was like somebody hit a switch and go, "Okay, we're done. We played at pandemic quarantine, and now we're out." And
is yeah. How's that going to work out?
Yeah. Well, we know how it works out.
Yeah. The thing is that, but you know, there's also so much that we don't know. I mean, should we have followed this a modified version of the Swedish model? But that, of course, would assume that we're all Swedes. And which is a flaw not a safe there. Assumption. Yeah, right. So, I am baffled. And, you know, so I just, you know, I wear my mask, and I don't go out a lot. But, you know, that thing about being trapped in an apartment, and I remember some of the crap apartments that I lived in when was, you know, in my 20s, and some of those things I really would have been crawling the walls. Not that I, when my 20s, wasn't crawling the walls anyway. But you know, houses up here, we live in the absolute middle of nowhere in rural New Hampshire. We're a long way from Boston. We're a long way from anything. We're a long way from Ben and Jerry's, and houses are being just snapped up for ridiculous prices everywhere. I mean, people are desperate to get out of the cities, to have a little bit of that backyard. And some of these people are going to be in for a rude shock in about a month when the weather up here turns. It turns into an argument in favor of global warming is what it turns into.
Well, I live in Wisconsin, so I understand what you mean there. But it is interesting how hot the real estate market is. And I think in part because people are realizing, hey, maybe I don't need to commute and go into an office. Things are going to change. Okay, so PJ, we want to talk about your book, but do you want to engage in some rank punditry?
Sure. And it will be rank in every sense of the word.
Well, having acknowledged that people like, you know, H.L. Mencken got things horrifically wrong.
I was wrong about every single 2016 Republican potential candidate, wrong about the election itself. And Donald Trump seems to then I predicted that maybe he would grow in the job.
I didn't make that mistake, but yeah. Well, so I was really, I so was
if,
really
if you want wrong, yeah. You've come to the right place.
Well, see, this is the thing. I was really embarrassed. I remember the morning after the election, I was thinking, boy, I'm really going to get a lot of, you know, shit for this. Because I was really wrong. And then I realized everybody else in the world was too. So, yeah.
If you weren't wrong, you weren't paying attention.
I felt that way. So I am torn. I actually did a thing yesterday. It was a conversation with my future self, like the day after the election or the day after we know who wins the election, you know. Could I be wrong again? What would the factors be for, you know, Trump pulling out an electoral college victory and, you know, the African-American vote didn't come out, that there were these hidden Trump voters, that the boat parades turned out to be much more predictive than anybody imagined they would be. You know, the pandemic voting thing was. But you know what? Maybe it's going to be. Biden's been hit by 7 points, 7 points, 7 points, convention, 7 points, you know, next week, 7 points. And the day after the election, he will have won by 7 points, and we'll go, boy, wasn't that amazing? I don't know. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, you know.
Well, what I think is going to happen, and like I say, you're talking to Mr. Wrong here. What I think is going to happen is that Biden is going to win by a decisive margin, and that the Democrats are going to retain the House and take the Senate. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be in for 4 years of sort of Jimmy Carter on steroids, or the Jimmy's age, he's probably on steroids already. Jimmy Carter on crack, and it's not going to work. The chickens are going to come home. The debt chickens are going to come home and roost in the inflation nest or some awful thing. You can't just do this kind of money printing that we've been up to for the past decades without it eventually having some horrible backlash, which Biden will be captain of the ship. It will happen on his watch. That's going to happen. Their policies are going to be incredibly divisive. They're going to start screaming and yelling at each other instead of screaming and yelling at me. We're going to have a mess of a 4 years, but that's going to leave us, and maybe we had it coming, and maybe it's something we just have to go through. But the Republican Party has done so much damage to itself with Trump that at the end of this mess of 4 years, who will be the loyal opposition? Who will be the reasonable choice? Who will be the Ronald Reagan to take things?
Yeah, there's no back. Ronald Reagan anymore.
I'm not seeing one on the horizon. He may be way off in the distance, you know. And
I remember Ronald Reagan, and Nikki Haley is no Ronald Reagan.
No, she's great, but she's not. She doesn't have that kind of charisma. But then again, we didn't know that Reagan really had it either until he got going, and it was assumed, lest we forget, that the 1980 presidential election would be a very, very close run thing. It would be a Bush v. Gore sort of outcome,
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot, thinking at this point in 1980, did I know what was going to happen? I actually remember I was a reporter back then, and I was covering a Democratic rally, and Senator Gaylord Nelson was speaking. And I think either Nelson or somebody else was saying, you know, if Republicans win the Senate, this person will be the chairman of this committee and Jesse Helms will be the chairman of this committee and blah, blah. And I remember thinking, well, that's obviously not going to happen. I mean, clearly that was just unthinkable, because at that point, nobody could imagine that, say, in Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson was going to be defeated for re-election, much less that Reagan was going to win by a landslide. So these things do sometimes shift.
Yeah,
well, they tend to shift against incumbents at the last moment.
Let us look at 2008 as the perfect example. At this point, not quite at this point, but if you go back a couple of months in 2008, Barack Obama was an unspellable, unpronounceable guy with a name like a Martian alien, you know, who is like something like, you know, junior senator from Illinois. Yeah.
Named Barack Hussein Obama. That's going to happen, right?
Exactly.
Really, seriously.
Yeah. I mean, get out of here, you know. And he's going to take the nomination away from Hillary Clinton? I don't think so.
Well, about this point, though, maybe a little after this, I did realize what was going to happen in 2008, which is why I began binge watching The Wire. I watched all 5 seasons of The Wire to get myself through the 2008 election, which, by the way, was one of the better choices I made that year.
Having lived in Baltimore, yes, I would say that it was, you know, factual, not perhaps factual, but highly accurate.
Yeah, I think you're right, by the way, in your predictions, or you're probably right, including what a Biden presidency will look like. But it will feel like such a relief not to go through the crazy that, yeah, we're going to have these debates, but it might not have that sort of layer of toxic unreality with Trump. And I don't know. I wonder what's going to happen to the cable television stations, though, because I think a lot of people are going to go
out of business.
Okay, We are done with that. I mean, yeah. I just, you know, I am looking forward, not hanging on what's the president's latest outrage every single minute. I really am kind of looking forward to having a president that I can safely ignore for long periods of time. I genuinely crave
I don't know
that.
If, I think that Biden may be the president who'll do the ignoring for you. I'm not sure how safely ignored Biden can be. I think it's going to be a really chaotic first 2 years of his term, because I think by midterm, there'll probably be a shift in balance in the House and Senate.
Oh, yeah.
It may not be we didn't have Republicans back in control, but the Democratic loony left is going to take a beating in 2022, excuse me. But we're going to have a nutty couple of 2 years. It may keep the traditional news media alive for another year or two, but I would say as a long-term bet, short those organizations.
No, this is one of the, I won't say undercovered story, but it, when people look back at our period, the death of local media, you know, outside of the New York Times and the Washington Post and a handful of others, Wall Street Journal, maybe LA Times, what's happened? I mean, you're a print guy, just the decimation of local media, local journalism is really extraordinary. I mean, it really is changing the political culture.
It's dead and it's not coming back.
No, I don't see it coming back.
And I ask people, if you want to know the results of what kind of results we're going to get from the death and the fact that it's not coming back, go back to a time before the printing of newspapers was common, when there were very few newspapers and very few means of reliable news sources. This would be in the early 19th century. I mean, printing presses were around, but the whole media landscape as we knew it and as it evolved from newspapers into radio and television and so on, the whole broad-based news outlet world that we're losing right now had not been invented in the early 19th century, or was just in the process of being invented. And one of the upshots of that was, I would say, the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have Twitter, but we did have duels and civil wars.
Yes. Yeah, we didn't have Twitter, but we did have the ignorance that Twitter represents.
Right.
We had quiet ignorance. We had quiet ignorance instead of loud ignorance.
Yeah.
We had extreme polarization based on little information instead of extreme polarization based on too much information. But the effect could be the same. I'm not saying that it will be, but, you know.
Yeah.
The
cancel culture back then wasn't blocking somebody. It was Aaron Burr shooting Alexander Hamilton. So, I mean,
exactly. They had the cancel culture thing figured out. Yeah.
They were serious.
Yeah.
P.J. O'Rourke, the book is A Cry from the Far Middle, Dispatches from a Divided Land. It is a fantastic read, but you knew that. It is excerpted in today's Bulwark. P.J. O'Rourke, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Charlie. Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are now 54 days to go until the election.